Hello, and welcome to episode number 82 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. The enigma known as the UFO phenomenon is compelling for numerous reasons. One of those reasons is that this phenomenon has been attested to by witnesses and experiencers over long periods of modern history. And furthermore, once you get past the surface veneer of the way people have categorized slash interpreted these phenomena differently over time because of different cultural expectations, one can make a convincing argument, as Jacques Vallée and others have in fact done, that this phenomenon has been with us since the beginning of time. Sometimes interpreted as gods come down from the heavens to parade in front of we mere mortals, and more recently as advanced technological civilizations visiting us from far-flung destinations such as Zeta Reticuli and Alpha Centauri, on scientific expeditions and the like. Another of the key elements of data lending credence to the notion that this phenomenon is as real as green grass in the spring and plasma erupting from the sun is that it is attested to across the world, even in cultures significantly divorced from the typical modernist and physicalist conceptions found in Western civilization. Whenever we can show cross-cultural support for this phenomenon, we can more confidently conclude that this is not simply a construct based on the expectations of any particular people group. Indeed, the fact that the interpretation of sightings and interactions with the others have differed somewhat in different parts of the world over time actually lends credence to the notion that, underlyingly, beyond that surface veneer of categorization and interpretation, something is really there, legitimately being encountered and interacted with. Armchair skeptics will at times argue that this is simply a North American and European phenomenon, implying it really is merely a cultural construct after all, the imaginative fruit of the consumption of too many X-Files episodes and the like. Now, while it is statistically true that we have more data from these locations, it's important to point out that much of this can likely be attributed to the fact that some data gathering efforts haven't happened to the same degree in other places, and that even the cultural expectations of some of those other continents are such that what is a paradigm-shaking moment for a modern North American or European might not be for someone from an indigenous population, for example. After all, why make a big deal of an event that has been normalized in a particular culture for generations? And one can make the argument that this is indeed the case in various indigenous populations around the world. As I mentioned, some of the discrepancy in the regularity of reports from different parts of the globe can be reduced to the fact that the search simply hasn't been conducted with equal dedication around the world. Furthermore, cultural differences and language issues have added to this challenge. Thankfully, we do have pioneering researchers working to address this problem. Artie Sixkiller Clark is one such pioneer. As a professor emeritus at Montana State University, and former director of the Center for Bilingual/Multicultural Education, Clark, who is Cherokee/Choctaw herself, has dedicated decades of her life to investigating sightings of UFOs and interactions with various forms of alien and non-conventionally human beings in parts of the globe long neglected. In today's episode, we're going to consider the astounding reports Clark was able to gather during her trips through Mesoamerica, a region comprising the modern-day countries of northern Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Belize, and central to southern Mexico. Not only do the accounts Clark gathered make clear the fact that UFO sightings and interactions with actual beings are every much as common, perhaps even more so, there as compared to here, but they also raise very interesting possibilities regarding the very origins of some of these people groups, and specifically the Maya. Could the Maya themselves not only be the recipients of the traditions of a so-called ancient alien civilization, but perhaps even their very descendants? These are the very fascinating matters we'll endeavor to engage with head-on in this, the 82nd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. I'd like to begin this week's podcast with just a couple of announcements. First of all, a reminder that I will be speaking at the Ohio UFO Heritage Conference, which is coming up on May 5th and 6th of this year at the historic Hope Hotel at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. very excited about this conference. I think it's going to be an amazing event, and I hope you can join me and the other speakers there. Again, coming up on May 5th and 6th of this year, just over a month away at this point, 4 weeks and 5 days to be specific. The second announcement is just to remind everyone that I have really picked up the amount of content I'm creating as part of this podcast and other podcasts I'm a part of. Of course, in addition to Point of Convergence, which happens every couple weeks, I'm also a part of Liminal Frames with my friend Nathan. That happens on the weekends in between. And I'm also developing numerous other kinds of content for patrons and supporters of my work. So if you'd like to support this podcast and the work I do, I'd really appreciate that. And patrons get access to all sorts of additional content, including OTC Squared, which happens every month or so, where I update people on things that are happening with me and in the public. We address questions and answers, and I have a hot take section as well. I also have launched feature series of podcasts where I take a different topic and do a deep dive over multiple episodes into a particular topic. That's also for patrons and supporters. The first of those is now available. Episode 1 of The Raw Material is the first feature series that I have launched. I'm also working on an app that will hold all of this content for patrons and subscribers. And if you'd like to become a patron, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. Okay, let's get into today's topic. Now, we are talking about encounters, documented encounters between people living in Mesoamerica and various forms of non-human intelligence, alien beings, and the like. These encounters are documented in a book by Artie Sixkiller Clark titled Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. And this is how that book is described. Quote, Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, author of Encounters with Star People, vowed as a teenager to follow in the footsteps of two 19th century explorers, John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood, who brought the ancient Maya cities to the world's attention. Dr. Clark set out on a 7-year adventure from 2003 through 2010 through Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, collecting stories of encounters, sky gods, giants, little people, and aliens among the indigenous people. She drove more than 12,000 miles visiting 89 archaeological sites. Stevens and Catherwood visited only 44, and conducting nearly 100 individual interviews. The result is an enthralling series of unique, original, true stories of encounters with space travelers, giants, little people, and UFOs. Sky People may very well change the way you perceive and experience the world. Unquote. Now, as I said at the outset, often skeptics complain that all accounts about the UFO phenomenon rise from North America and Europe. Now, this is not for a lack of data, I would suggest, but for a lack of investigation. And again, Dr. Clark has done invaluable work in being the boots-on-the-ground investigator to gather these accounts from the other America, Mesoamerica, in this particular case. I also want to discuss something to do with so-called anecdotal evidence. I've raised this before, but it's worth doing so again because there are some new listeners, and I think it bears repeating because this is a really important point when it comes to scientific investigation of this phenomenon. Now, there is empirical data. That's one kind of data and evidence involving experimentation and observation. We also have data that can arise from witness testimony. And it's very important to point out here that while any individual witness account may be less than convincing, when you have numerous thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of reports over time that bear a striking resemblance to each other, meaning that different aspects of the accounts are very similar, even when these people didn't know each other and sometimes when they're coming from very different cultures and have had no real interest in the UFO phenomenon prior to their encounters, then this together creates a very compelling data set. Each of those accounts is a data point, which together create a data set, which is very convincing, very compelling, and something that scientists do consider in other forms of investigation. So that should definitely be the case with the UFO phenomenon. So sometimes, again, armchair skeptics may say, well, that doesn't count, that's just anecdotal. But again, that's not really the case here because we have numerous accounts containing, again, numerous repeating elements, which suggest when taken in toto that this is really something real in our environment, something that is repeatable and does repeat itself even in the experience of very different kinds of people. So this is compelling evidence, and we should take it seriously. Now again, what's interesting here in this case today is we're finally hearing about really compelling data coming from places other than North America and Europe. And not only that, but some of the history of some of these other people groups actually leads us to beg the question, could their very history, their very origins, in fact, be somehow connected to these people groups, these sky people that are encountered there? And there's reasons why we would suggest this might be the case, and we'll get to that later in this episode. Much of it has to do with what these people remember being told by some of these beings. Some of their lore goes back generations and generations and generations. Again, we often don't hear about this in North America and Europe, in the Western world, but they actually hold these details as part of their shared, understood, cherished history. Now, just because it's part of their understood history doesn't mean we should necessarily take that as the so-called gospel truth. We should investigate. We should consider it amongst other possibilities. But while that's the case, I would also just bring to your attention that the conventional archaeological slash anthropological mainstream also very often presents a narrative that includes elements that are not really provable, and much of it is based on supposition, things that are just assumed to be the case. And because they hold the sway in our culture today, we assume sometimes they have more evidence for these notions than they actually do when you really dive into it. Again, this is where some of the controversy arises over people like Graham Hancock, who, when he looks at the evidence in prehistory even, what he concludes is that we see evidence of sophisticated civilizations present on the Earth prior to any kind of date that would be acknowledged or even made possible by the conventional mainstream. So again, the conventional mainstream likes to present this notion that, this narrative that, we have incremental linear progress over time, going from zero up to where we are today as a modern, sophisticated human civilization. Hancock and others have suggested this is a bit of a false narrative, or at least a narrative that's constructed on as many holes as some other narratives. And again, Hancock, when he looks at the evidence, sees suggestion that there were sophisticated civilizations present on the Earth prior to what we would consider point zero, so to speak, the beginning of human history, in other words. Now, in that same vein, Dr. Clark, in this book and some of her other books, is suggesting that perhaps the very origins of some different people groups are not what we think they are. They're not what we've been told they are. And I really think there's something to this. When I'm honest with you, when I look at what I've seen, I really do question this notion that all human beings have the exact same source. I think we actually might have energetic imprints, overlays, as part of our background, even from different species, including species that may not be limited to terrestrial origins. So again, much of the archaeological, anthropological mainstream, I think, is based on some assumptions. And when you undo some of those assumptions, some other possibilities come into the mix. So I think we should really consider what Dr. Clark has to say here, and we can look at the reasons why she draws the conclusion she does and go from there. So without further ado, let's dive into some of the accounts, the fascinating accounts contained in this book, Sky People. Now, as we dive into these accounts, let's keep in mind who we're talking about here. Many of these accounts are shared by the Maya. Now, the Maya are an ancient people group that developed one of the most advanced civilizations in the Americas long ago. They developed a written language of hieroglyphs and the mathematical concept of zero, and they did this 2,000 years ago. In addition, they had expertise in astronomy and, again, mathematics, and they developed a complex and accurate calendar system. They were also known for elaborate ceremonial architecture, such as pyramids, temples, palaces, and observatories. Now, these structures were built apparently without metal tools, which is a marvel in itself. So again, this is one of the pieces of evidence that Clark would have us consider and others would have us consider. The point being, if it's true that we have this linear, incremental progress in history, why do we see evidence of ancient cultures like the Maya, who seem to have developed such a sophisticated civilization far before we really think that is possible, again, according to the conventional mainstream? Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, one data point that is found across the world that really lends credence to the notion that these things really were happening is that we see them arising, co-arising, in different parts of the world bearing striking resemblance to each other. One of these notions that we hear about in different parts of the world is the arising of some kind of species that seem to be giants, much larger than typical humankind. We, of course, see this mentioned in the Old Testament, in the Bible, in reference to a group known as the Nephilim, who also were involved with mating with human females, producing so-called hybrids. Now, of course, they weren't called hybrids when you read about that in the Bible. But when you think about the notion, it's almost exactly the same as what we hear about in the modern UFO phenomenon, where people are abducted, contacted, whatever you want to call it, and then later on, hybrid beings appear that seem to be very much half-human, half-alien of some variety. Well, Dr. Clark also encounters those kinds of tales, those kinds of narratives, when she investigates encounters in Mesoamerica. We're going to discuss one of those right now. And quoting here, in this chapter, Gabriel tells his story of blue-skinned men, unquote. Quoting again, quote, when I was a boy, I always heard rumors and stories of space giants. I grew up in the Cayo District, where Barren Creek Cave is located. It is a complex cave with hundreds of passageways, where over time, different visitors and inhabitants, including the Maya and the space giants, lived. My grandfather told me that in his youth, he saw the giants just outside the town of San Ignacio. That would have been in the 1880s, I believe. Unquote. Now, this person goes on to describe finding a skull when he was a child that was much too large to be the skull of a man. And he actually brought it to his grandfather, who was shocked and afraid when he saw the skull because it reminded him of these giants. And again, these giants were known to do some things that were somewhat nefarious, and you'll soon find out why. Quoting from the book again, quote, we took the skull back to the village and reported to my grandfather. I read the fear on his face, but he said nothing. That afternoon, we took the skull into the forest and buried it for safekeeping. That made my grandfather happier. Months later, we heard of a wise man up near the Guatemalan border who knew of such things. We made the journey and took the skull to him. He said it was a space giant, but from the blue kind. The blue kind? What does that mean? The blue kind were the blue-skinned giants of the old stories told thousands of years ago. The blue-skinned giants were different because they had eyes in the front of their head and in the sides. What did the wise man tell you about the blue-skinned giants? He said they were diminishing in number and that they were becoming extinct. That is the reason they stole women. They were trying to preserve their race. Unquote. Now again, if a typical person on the street were to hear this story, they would say it's a quaint story, a nice story, perhaps even a scary story, but one that's just that, a story, based on fantastical lore. But again, I just bring to your attention that when we think about the modern UFO phenomenon, many of the encounters are quite similar. Certainly the element about both women and men being taken, and then their genetic material being extracted, their reproductive material being extracted, eggs in the case of women, and sperm in the case of men, in order to actually generate these hybrid beings. This is very much part of the modern UFO phenomenon. And in fact, it's one of the most well-attested elements of the UFO phenomenon literature. Furthermore, as I already pointed out, we also have very similar encounters depicted in the Bible, a holy book, a sacred group of texts that billions of people around the world use as their guidebook for life. And they actually believe history is based on the accounts to some degree or another of this book, this collection of books we call the Bible colloquially. Well, again, what does that say? Perhaps this is really attesting to something that really has been happening, not just in ancient days, in biblical days, or in ancient lore described in Mesoamerican history, but actually even today, that this is ongoingly happening. And this is right under the noses of our modern, sophisticated, science-centric civilization that believes that such things couldn't be anything more than fairy tales. But again, if that's all they are, why are they so well attested to all across the world? And why is it coming from witnesses even today that by any standard are the most credible kind of witnesses you could find? All right, let's move on to the next account as depicted in Artie Clark's book, Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. Now, this next account also has elements within it that mirror so much of the modern UFO phenomenon, including missing time and encounters with beings that appear decidedly insectoid, for lack of a better term. Quoting from this chapter, The Insect Man, quote, last month, it was very early morning. I left my home about 6 a.m. I wanted to get to the city when the shops opened so I could return to the restaurant before dinner time. The drive is monotonous. I became sleepy and decided to pull off the side of the road, walk around, and smoke a cigarette. My drive had been uneventful, and I was ahead of schedule. He paused, fished a cigarette out of a pack in his front shirt pocket, lit it, and took a long drag, releasing the smoke slowly. The sun was coming up, the air was still, and it was cool. He paused, sipped from the glass of sangria, and inhaled his cigarette. I was standing just in front of the van looking toward the south when I saw something out of the corner of my eye. At first, I thought it was an airplane, and I became frightened. It was very low, and I thought it was going to crash. When it came my way, I realized there were no wings. It was like a big gasoline tank, and as it soared over me, I dropped to my knees for fear it would strike me dead. For several moments, I couldn't move. I wondered how I could fly without wings. Enrique paused again, when one of his waiters approached him with a question. He excused himself and left the lounge. I looked around at the other tourists. A busload of 20-something French tourists had arrived at the hotel earlier in the day, and it looked as though most of them were sitting at the bar engaged in loud conversation. Several minutes passed before Enrique returned. "Sorry, doctor, a problem in the kitchen." He seated himself across from me again and called for another sangria. "Could you tell me more about the UFO?" I asked. "It was a long tank-like craft. If you've ever seen a gasoline tanker that delivers gas to the stations, it was like that, only about 5 times as long and 3 times as round. It was huge. It was bigger than my village if it was stretched from one end to the other." "What color was it?" "It was a dull gray. There were a few small indentations near the top. I thought they were windows, but it couldn't see lights. Maybe they can see out, but we cannot see them," he said. When I realized there were no wings, I was in shock, but the biggest shock came when it flew by me and it made no noise. A plane would roar, but there was nothing, only the wind that disturbed the calmness of the morning. "Was there anything else you can remember?" "The strangest thing was that as I was watching it, it seemed to vanish before my eyes and then reappear again. It did this twice, once when it was flying north to south and then again when it flew south to north. When it came back the second time, it vanished almost right in front of me. That is when I knew for sure it was a UFO." "Can you tell me anything else about the craft?" "I decided to hide behind the van. I didn't want to be abducted. I've heard they take you and do experiments. I didn't want to lose my job because of a UFO. At the same time, I was very excited. Actually, seeing a UFO is very exciting, and I kept thinking, they don't even know I'm here." He paused and laughed nervously. Enrique took another drink of sangria and offered to refresh my glass. "Did something else happen?" I asked. "I watched until the craft was out of sight, thinking to myself that they did not know I was there. I returned to the driver's side of the van. That's when I heard what I thought was a car door slam. I turned because I thought someone else had seen the UFO. That's when I saw 2 rolling balls of light. They blinded me. I raised my arm to shield my eyes." Enrique lifted his arms to show me how he had covered his eyes. He leaned back in his chair and lit another cigarette from the ashes of the existing cigarette in his hand. "Do you want to continue?" "Oh yes, I'm just trying to remember every detail. This is important, isn't it?" "Yes," I replied. "Take your time." Suddenly, I was aware that the lights were no longer shining. I dropped my arm and came face to face with 2 creatures who walked out of the balls of light. I called them creatures because that is what they were. Even though they had 2 arms and 2 legs, they were not human. They were shorter than me. Enrique is approximately 5'6". "They had funny skin. It looked like the color of these ashes," he said as he pointed to the ashtray on the table, "somewhere between white and gray. Their heads were pointed at the chin. Their arms and legs were very skinny, making me think they were children, at least at first. But the truth is, they looked like insects, nothing more than big bugs." "You said the creatures looked like insects. Can you tell me anything else about them?" "They were wearing strange suits. They blended with the environment some way. If they stood in front of a bush, they looked like the bush. If they stood in the dirt, they looked like the dirt. Whatever was behind them, they blended. I knew they were aliens, and I ran for the van. That's when the balls of light appeared, and the creatures disappeared. The UFO moved over me and stayed there, a few feet above me. There was a sickening smell, and I think I lost consciousness." Unquote. Now, I'm sure you noted there that the description of these beings fit many of the descriptions we hear from North America and Europe. Furthermore, he describes these sophisticated suits they were wearing that actually seemed to offer camouflage. In other words, they would blend in against whatever background they were standing against. Now, at the end of the account there, you notice that Enrique talks about losing consciousness. When he came to, there actually was numerous hours that had gone by that he could not account for. So even though it felt to him almost seamless, he realized there was actually numerous hours had gone by in between that he couldn't account for, and actually got in trouble with his boss when he returned because he was so late from his trip. So again, this mirrors much of the accounts we hear about in modern day North America and Europe as well. Now we're going to jump forward into the book to another chapter where we not only encounter people seeing strange phenomena in the sky, but we also hear first mention of this notion in the Mayan lore that they actually are the descendants of some of these sky people. Quoting from that chapter, quote, "People who have been abducted by UFOs are usually called abductees or experiencers. Due to a lack of physical evidence, the majority of scientists and mental health professionals dismiss the phenomenon as fantasy proneness, false memory syndrome, sleep paralysis, psychopathology, and a variety of environmental factors. Dr. John E. Mack, a respected Harvard University psychiatrist, devoted a substantial amount of time to investigating such cases. He found that in the most compelling cases, his patients suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. As he noted, this would imply that his patients genuinely believed that they remembered their abductions. In this chapter, you will read stories about abduction from villagers who live near Palenque Town." Unquote. Now we're going to jump further into that chapter where she discusses encounters with one particular person. Quote, "On my third visit to Palenque, I was unable to locate Manolo, so I hired a guide named Pax. A full-blooded Maya, Pax was a small, wiry man who spoke near-perfect English as he ushered me around the site. His back was slightly hunched and he walked with a definite limp. He told me he had been working at the Palenque ruins for almost 40 years and that it was getting more difficult to obtain clients because of his age. As we slowly walked the grounds, I asked him about Pakal, the ancient king, who gained fame as an ancient astronaut. He laughed and asked me if I believed in the ancient astronaut theory. I was surprised at how knowledgeable he was about the theory and the works of Eric von Daniken. He was just a white man who came up with a way to make money, he said. For some reason, the white man always wants answers that suit his beliefs. If von Daniken accepted the fact that the Maya built the cities unaided by extraterrestrials, then that would mean our civilization was more advanced than the white man. That would never do for race who believe they are superior. So he provided an answer that was acceptable to the world of the white man. People grasp onto things that make them feel they are superior." "Do the Maya ever question who built the cities?" I asked. "We do not have to. We know our ancestors built the cities. We are their direct descendants. We know where we come from and where we are going," he replied, offering no further explanation. And now we'll jump a little further into the chapter. Quote, "The next day I met Pax at the ancient site. Are you still interested in ancient astronauts, Doctora?" he asked as he led me through the dense jungle. I watched as he hacked our way through the jungle forest with a machete. Occasionally he stopped and caught his breath. "I'm still collecting stories when someone has a story to tell," I said. "I have some friends who have stories to tell. I talked to them yesterday. They will talk to you. For those who do not speak English, I can translate." "Thanks, Pax. I would really like to hear their stories. I've heard that there are regular sightings of UFOs at Palenque." And then jumping forward again, when they have gathered a few people to talk about their encounters, one person says, quote, "I have a story to tell," the youngest of the group began. He stood up from the table and picked up another Coca-Cola. He was a handsome man. If I had not known better, I would have thought from his profile that he was Pakal, whose image could be seen throughout the monuments in the ancient city. His countenance was identical to the king of the ancient city. "I would be honored to hear your story," I said. "My name is Mario. I had an encounter with four aliens about 10 years ago. I was 14 then, but I still remember it. It was on my way to see my sweetheart, who is now my wife. I saw him look towards the house and noticed several women milling around the door. He caught his wife's attention and pointed her out to me. She looked at me and smiled. Where were you when you saw the aliens?" I asked. "I was on my way to see Lucinda. She lived about 4 miles from me in another village. I was walking. It was a black, dark night. Occasionally the moon would come out from the clouds and cast a faint light on the jungle. I was nervous. A jaguar had been seen a few days back. I repeatedly shined my flashlight around the road and the forest to check for danger, but suddenly the light went out. I shook the flashlight, trying to get it to come to life. About the same time, a bright light appeared over the forest and moved directly over the road. It stopped in front of me. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to run, but I was paralyzed, unable to move. He lit a cigarette. All eyes around the table were on him. "Are you telling me the spacecraft landed?" I asked. "Yes, I saw steps descend from the bottom of a strange round machine, and four men came out of it. As they got closer, their silver suits glistened in the light. I had never seen such dress. One carried some kind of instrument, and when he pointed at me, I felt sick." "What do you mean you felt sick?" "It was as though lightning had struck me. I felt needles all over my body. I felt I was burning alive. Then the pain stopped and I was sick. Stomachache. I threw up. I remember that." "What else do you recall?" I asked. "I'm not sure. Possibly I passed out. The next thing I remember is waking up inside the craft, but I could not focus my eyes. The light was too bright. There was a cold dampness to the room. I was lying on my stomach on a hard surface, and when I tried to move, I realized I was strapped down. My back was in terrible pain. I had never had back pain. Panic set in, but before I had a chance to think of a way to escape, I woke outside my papa's place. Off in the distance, I saw a bright light against a black sky. One moment it was there, one moment it was gone. I decided I must be dreaming and put it out of my mind until I met Tohil, who told me what happened to him." He put his hand on the shoulder of his friend, who sat beside him. "Have you had any further encounters?" I asked. "None. One was enough." I heard the men chuckle in the background. I looked at them. They were not laughing at Mario so much as reacting to the fear of the unknown. I looked at his friend Tohil, who until that moment had been silent. "My friend is shy, Senora. It is difficult for him to tell his story." "I understand that, Tohil. You do not have to tell me," I said. "No, Senora, I do want to tell. I just don't speak English as good as Mario. I hope he will understand me. It happened on the same row, but I was with my friend Lorenzo." "Were you taken on board their craft?" I asked. "Si. There were four small men who take us. We fought, but we were no match for them. I think they have some way of making you helpless. They took us on their ship and put us in a room with strangers." "Were the strangers Maya?" I asked. "Maybe one or two, but some were white with yellow hair. Some wore a nightgown. Some were dressed in, I can't remember the word." He paused and spoke in Spanish to his friend, who did not seem to understand what he was trying to say. "Were they wearing work clothes, formal clothes, like evening gowns, school clothes?" I asked. "Yes, fancy clothes." "And others?" "Different clothes. It was like they were all taken in the middle of something else, like going to bed or something, or working, or out for the evening." "And from your description, would you say they were all from Mexico?" I asked. "I don't think so. Too many blondes, maybe from all over the world. None of them saw me. No emotion, no fight. They just sat there. No movement, no life in them. I tried to talk to one man, but he did not react. The short one saw me trying to talk to the others, and they forcibly removed me to a room away from everyone." He paused and looked at Mario. "They forced me to drink some kind of liquid that tasted of dirt. It was thick and slimy, and I almost threw up. After a few minutes, they put me inside a machine and turned me upside down. I stayed there for several minutes. I could not move. I felt numb, except I was wide awake. My head felt like it was going to explode. I don't know how long they kept me there, but the next thing I remember, Lorenzo and me were standing alone on the dark road and the craft was disappearing." "Can you describe the craft?" I asked. "It was a long cylinder. It had a lot of bright lights, but the whole craft seemed to glow from a bright red to an orange. Once it settled to the ground, it was a light orange, but the colors were some kind of glowing lights. I never figured that out." "Can you describe the beings that captured you?" "Not well. They were short and powerful. They never spoke, but I understood what they wanted." "Do you remember any other features of your abductors?" "Senora, I think they drugged me because I fought so much, so everything was blurry to me." "Where was your friend Lorenzo while you were enduring their experiments?" I asked. "I don't know. I have no memory of seeing him until we found ourselves on the road together." Unquote. Now again, those of you familiar with the data from the UFO phenomenon and who've been tuning into this podcast from the outset will recognize many of these elements. This is very common to the UFO phenomenon. Abduction, missing time, telepathic communication, people who seem to be in a daze while being on board the craft, etc. I also want to point out something really important here. While the earlier person she was talking to, Pax, talked about believing that they actually descended from some of these space people, some of these extraterrestrials, it should be noted that throughout this book, it's made clear that numerous different kinds of beings were encountered. And again, as I've said many times, I think this is one of the most shocking aspects of disclosure, because this is not just about adding one more type of being to our understanding of reality and the environment we're in. but actually that there are numerous types of beings coming from completely different origin sources much of the time that are actually all around us. And perhaps up until now, because of their sophistication, we've been kept in a kind of quarantine where we've not usually been made aware of their presence, but they are everywhere and they go back to the very beginning. And there are many, many different kinds. So even though many of the Maya believe they actually descended from a group of these beings that came from the stars, quote unquote, they also encounter many other types of beings. And it seems like certain parts of the world are almost like portals for both interstellar and interdimensional travel. And even when I mention those two terms, interstellar and interdimensional, as I said before, I think in the long run, those terms will collapse into something deeper and broader, and that these speak, if nothing else, to the lack of our true understanding of the nature of reality at this point. What's also made clear in the data discussed by Clark and her interviews with these different witnesses in Mesoamerica, and that's also attested to throughout the UFO phenomenon literature, while some people want to paint this as all love and light or all demons and darkness, two extremes on the spectrum, what I think the data tells us is that we have quite a spectrum that goes kind of across the gamut. And this speaks to different developmental levels of these different groups. So again, I think we do a disservice to the data when we try to reduce it to one kind of thing, one group, operating at one kind of developmental level. The truth is much more complex, as is the case in our everyday world as well, of course. And now we're going to jump forward into the book to chapter 43, which is titled, They Avoid Tourists. This actually speaks to the changes that have happened in Mesoamerica, how some places have become tourist hotspots that used to be quite remote, and how this change, this transformation, while it has brought some additional wealth to the area, does not come without some significant cost, including in terms of the interactions with these other kinds of beings, including the sky people who the Maya believe they descend from. Quoting from this chapter, quote, 5 decades ago, no one knew about Cancun. In 1969, a huge building project was launched, and by 1974, an international airport and 3 luxury hotels had been built to draw tourists. Today, Cancun is one of the premier holiday destinations in North America. In this chapter, you will hear from an elder who tells how the real sky people quit coming to the Yucatan with the advent of the tourist industry, unquote. Now, jumping forward in that chapter, quote, Chalk, the elder who had agreed to talk with me, came from the back of the house and welcomed us. I was immediately mesmerized by his smile. He held out his hand to me. His gentle, warm touch put me at ease. He offered us orange juice from his orchard while he arranged some wooden stools for us to sit. When I was a boy, they used to come here. They quit coming in the mid-70s. Do you have any idea why they stopped visiting the area? The old ones say they disapproved of the tourists coming to the area. The Yucatan was home of the Maya until the 1960s. The Mexicans left us alone. The government left us alone. The men from the stars considered the Yucatan their second home. But after the tourists came, the purity of the Yucatan was lost. The sky people don't like tourists. I understood the changes he was addressing. The development of Cancun had made for drastic alterations throughout the Yucatan. Do you remember the days when the sky people came to visit? I asked. Sí. Can you tell me about those days? I remember this one time. It was a celebration. All of the old men from the village and nearby villages were present. We feasted on turkey, peppers, beans, and tortillas. There was so much food. When all of a sudden, over the village, a sky machine appeared. Can you describe it? I asked. It was round and big. It covered the whole village. It turned a bright sunny day into a dark day. It shaded the sun. Blue sparks of light spit out from underneath. It was quite a sight for a boy like me. I had never seen lights before. It stayed that way for the longest time, and everyone just sat there staring upward at this object from the sky. Was there any fear? No, we knew about the sky people. We were not afraid of them. The sky machine hung overhead for what seemed like a long time, but it was probably only minutes. Then 3 sky men appeared. They walked directly to the elders and escorted them on board the ship. After an hour or so, the elders came out of the ship. Can you describe the sky men? I asked. They looked like us, except they were taller. We were a shorter version of them. Did the elders tell you anything about their meeting? Only that they talked about the future of the earth and how the population growth and greed would bring about its destruction. Did they explain to you how this might occur? They said diseases, no food, and wars would destroy the earth as we know it. Now, jumping a little forward in the story, Dr. Clark says, "You spoke about a machine that came from the sky, and the elders entered the machine to speak with the skymen. I've heard that the elders could travel in space. Can you tell me anything about that?" I asked. "There is a place on each pyramid that is the portal to the stars. The elders would enter the portal to travel in space. The elders travel to meet the sky people. That is how they knew so much about the universe." "Do they continue to do that today?" I asked. Chalk paused and finished his glass of orange juice. "When the tourists came, the sky people chose to stay away. The portals were closed. We believe someday they will open again, but not until the tourists leave." "Do you believe that there will be a day when there are no tourists?" "Oh, see, it is coming. The day will come when the world is too dangerous for travel and people will stay home. Cancun will be replaced by jungle again." "Why will it become too dangerous to travel?" "There will be diseases at first. People will be afraid to leave their homes. Food will become scarce because there will be no one to produce it. Then the wars will come." "What do you think will happen to the Maya when these events occur?" "We will survive. We have always survived. We will just disappear into the jungles and wait until the earth is reborn and the fifth world begins. It has been foretold by the wise men. It will happen. You should take heed." Unquote. Now, that last section was interesting, not just because, again, it speaks to the Maya's belief that they actually descend from some of these sky people, from some of these civilizations of extraterrestrial intelligence, but they actually believe also that a cataclysm of sorts awaits humanity, partly because of its own foolishness. And again, we find that echoed in many, many different traditions, a kind of end times that is foretold, not just in Christianity, but in numerous indigenous traditions and other traditions found around the world. And of course, as I've said before on this podcast, many, many experiencers encounter this kind of apocalyptic vision when they encounter various of these others. And you could argue that that's been ramping up of late. Now let's move to the conclusions that Clark draws after considering her various interviews over years and years with various Maya. Quoting from the epilogue, Clark writes, quote, "As I complete this book, there is one resounding fact that haunted me throughout my journey among the Maya. The Maya say that when they reached Mesoamerica, they brought their knowledge with them. This fact sets the Maya apart from other indigenous groups. A closer examination reveals that nowhere in the ancient stories of the Maya is there a declaration that they learned the secrets of civilization on Earth. They have no myths of great teachers or individuals who taught them how to live. They have no legends of gods coming from the West or the East or from any other direction. So when the Spaniards arrived, the Maya did not welcome them with open arms. Instead, they kept out of sight and hid in the jungle when the Spaniards came near them. Unlike the Aztecs and other indigenous groups, the Maya clearly did not regard the Spaniards as gods, quote unquote. I spoke with one elder Maya who told me the Maya did not view the Spaniards as technologically advanced. We knew technologically advanced civilizations. We came from one. The Spaniards were not superior to us. To me, this statement speaks volumes and bolsters my view that the Maya were not assisted by aliens from space. They were the space travelers." Unquote. And in the concluding paragraph of this book, Clark says, quote, "At the conclusion of his exploration, Stevens insisted that the ruins he had investigated were those of a great indigenous civilization, born of an inherent genius apart from the influence of any known group. I believe that Stevens' conclusions were far more prophetic than he realized. In spending countless days and weeks with the Maya, I am convinced that they came to Earth. The spacemen were us, was an expression I heard repeatedly. From my research, I believe the Maya of today are the descendants of those who came to planet Earth from another world. They were not assisted by alien astronauts. They were the ancient astronauts." Unquote. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.